Merry Christmas and welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Claus Dimes.
And I'm little drummer Brian Rohenbacher.
He plays drums, so makes sense. It is almost Christmas time, and let's be real. According to our advent calendar, Christmas passed a long time ago.
All that chocolate's gone.
Maybe, I don't know.
I was actually, okay, so like I legit love advent calendars.
Yeah.
I got one for myself. And the serving size on the back is 7 pieces. So like...
They want
you. So I just like went through 1 week at a time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Anyway, we have a great Christmas episode for you today. In RTB 101, we'll see a clip on how the Christmas star guided the wise men featuring astrophysicist Hugh Ross.
And in Give and Take, Jeff Sorink will be talking with philosopher and theologian Ken Samples about celebrating Christmas.
Yeah, I've heard Ken Samples talk about just how he loves Christmas so much and how he celebrates it. So really looking forward to that segment and everything he's going to bring to the table.
Right. No, it'll be some traditional stuff, some new stuff. I think it's just he brings a good flavor to it.
That's
to the
right.
conversation.
Before we get to that, though, we have Culture Talk. Sandra's going to be taking a little bit of a break from Christmas stuff to talk to theologian and philosopher of ethics Joseph Miller on a historical Adam and Eve and race. Very important discussion for us to be having right now, so let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. I'm joined today with Dr. Joe Miller. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So you are the co-founder of the Center for Cultural Apologetics, and we're going to be talking about something very culturally relevant, and that is issues of race.
Mm.
So
easy topic.
I know, no easy topic. But you know, I think it's an important topic that we need to discuss. And we're going to be talking about Adam and Eve and what they have to do with racism, because it wouldn't necessarily be something that people think has to do with racism, but let's talk about it. So first, before we dive into Adam and Eve, what are some alternative views to biblical creation of humanity?
Yeah, so definitely a topic there's a lot of different opinions about, even not just now, but I mean, for the past several hundred years, there's been a lot of divergent views because it is such an important topic. Mm-hmm. People weigh in, but they all have different views. And so I think some of the live views, obviously, if you reject Christianity, if you reject the Bible completely, so if you're an atheist or naturalist of some kind, agnostic, there would be no Adam and Eve, it was just purely evolved animals to humans. Mm-hmm. There are Christians called theistic evolutionists who would also say that that's true, but they say to some degree or another, God had a hand in that process. Some would say from just the moment of creation, others say, oh, he's allowed to do miracles along the way, but it's some form of theistic evolution. Mm-hmm. Or there's a biblical creation that God created one pair of humans as the sole progenitors of mankind. Mm-hmm. And there's a few other views sprinkled in there that we might get to, but those are the three basic categories that people kind of fall into.
So kind of the gist is either God created Adam and Eve, he specially created Adam and Eve, or he somehow tinkered with
the evolutionary process.
Or God doesn't exist. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do these different views then handle racial distinction?
Yeah, so we know that race really is an invention of culture that really didn't start to the 18th, 19th century. So before that, the concept of race really wasn't around until those Enlightenment thinkers like Kant and Hume started to create these philosophies of seeing people based on skin as, tribalism has always been there, but not purely based on skin. Mm-hmm. And then you saw this sort of come in with Darwin, and he traded on that and added a scientific basis for those differences. Mm-hmm. And what that did for the discussion of historical origins was that people realized that Adam and Eve was kind of the linchpin to what you would believe about the science of race. And what I find historically is that most Christians who were able to resist the cultural tendency towards racial discrimination held firmly to historical Adam and Eve as progenitors. Didn't safeguard it, it wasn't perfect. There were still people that unfortunately bowed to that cultural pressure. But that was the safest, the view that gave the most solid, safest foundation for rejecting it.
So you've written about and discussed the science of racism.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about the origin of humanity and whether it's through Adam and Eve or through evolution, whether God had a hand in that or not, how does one or the other open up the door to the science of racism.
Yeah. So I think what you have, broadly speaking, is that when you take God out of the special creation picture, that Adam and Eve were made specially created, distinct from the animal kind, their own kind, and that sacred image of God, you end up with some way or another, people are going to be weighed on a grade of hierarchy, higher or lower. And some people do it on race, and they say, oh, well, that's wrong, but they do it on other factors. Mm-hmm. But you end up opening yourself to some sort of gradation of humanity with those other views that reject special creation. And so I think that it's, in my study at least, it really kind of comes with the territory that you're opening yourself up to it, even if you want to resist it.
Right. You know? So a skeptic, I think, would say, though, that sure, maybe we're opening the door to racism by taking this view that that Adam and Eve aren't the first humans. But surely Christians are not innocent, because Christians have used the Bible claimed, you know, Adam and Eve as the first humans, but still somehow engage in racial bigotry and discrimination. So how do you engage in that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, first you got to face it head on. It's true, and people did. And so the question we ask is, was that view compatible with their worldview or incompatible? And what I'd first say is that those Christians that did engage in racial prejudices and bias, despite the fact that they held to historic Adam and Eve as the sole progenitors, were violating in some core way that biblical doctrine. They were out of line or out of step with that. Mm-hmm. But others invented things. Like people know, like there's this thing called the curse of Ham that was around for a long time before Darwin and scientific racism. Mm-hmm. But that said, hey, we're all created in God's image, but because of sin, a certain racial group was, you know, pushed lower on the value. They lost their sacred worth. Mm-hmm. And so therefore they're meant to be the slaves of all the other non-cursed races. So people invented theologies to counteract the theology that would have otherwise protected sacredness. So it's very troubling to see that happen.
Right. And I think because it is so troubling, especially from a skeptic's perspective, of like, hey, I don't want anything to do with this because this is using a holy book that people believe in to then engage in behavior that isn't so holy. So how can Christians then kind of differentiate between viewing Adam and Eve as the first humans and then somehow distorting that to still being okay with racism and bigotry?
Yeah, I think there's definitely several tactics people could use to approach that. One is just simply pointing out that you're stuck, because even if you take the naturalist non-theistic approach, if you take that led clearly to those sort of racial things, so that if we're discounting it based on its advocates, then you can't accept, you know, naturalism either. So you're left with, how are we going to figure this out? And so I think what you have to do is pull it back to which worldview, which foundation gives me the most coherent and the strongest foundation for being able to consistently reject that, not just for me or my culture, not just now when it's politically correct to reject it, but what happens when it's not politically correct, when it's okay, or when it's okay essentially to be a racist? Well, could I still stand up to that? Do I still have an argument against it? And I believe that this doctrine of historic Adam and Eve gives us the best foundation for being able to stand up to the cultural norms that will otherwise dehumanize people. And it's beyond the issue of race, too. It's other issues as well, other dehumanizing constructs that the culture creates. It's the best foundation. Not perfect, because we can still be people of our culture.
Right. No, that's true. Well, thank you for that. I know it's the tip of the iceberg.
A little tiny bit, right?
It's such a huge, huge topic. But I know that people are going to probably want to know more about this topic. So I'm going to point our viewers to your site. So if you would like more on this topic, go to morethancake.org and you can find videos and articles from Dr. Joe Miller.
Welcome. This is Joe Aguirre along with astronomer Dr. Hugh Ross. We're continuing our conversation. Today, Hugh is going to address the question, how did the star guide the wise men to Jesus?
Well, Joe, this is one of the more controversial aspects of the story of the Star of Bethlehem. And it's because the English translations of Matthew 2 give you the impression, at least in the King James translation and several other translations, that the star was actually pointing the way to the door of the house where Joseph and Mary and Jesus lived there in Bethlehem. And what I'm going to do is read for you what the text says, not in an English translation, but a translation into English of the literal Greek. So just exactly how the Greek says it. And it's up here in this next slide. And it says, "Behold, the star which they saw in the east went before them until coming it stood over where was the child." Now the key word in this sentence is the verb that's translated stood over. It's the Greek verb histemi, and it's got a very broad range of definition. And again, we have a slide here that shows you this range of definitions. It means to cause or make to stand, to appoint, place, put, or set, or to make firm, to fix or establish, to cause something or someone to keep its place, or to sustain something. In other words, it's got such a broad range of definition, it may not mean pointing the way or standing over at all. It could simply be an indication that they're on the right track. And if you read what you see in the rest of Matthew 2, the star appeared in the east, it disappeared, and when they came to Jerusalem, they inquired of the religious leaders as to the location of this king of the Jews. That tells us that the star they saw in the east did not tell them the direction to go. It simply told them the timing of the coming of the Messiah. And they went to Jerusalem to inquire the religious leaders to learn about the location. And so the Magi knew the time, but not the location. The religious leaders didn't know the time, but they knew the location. Being familiar with Micah 5:2 is the one place where the Bible predicts where the Messiah would be born, namely Bethlehem. And Herod instructs the wise men, go down to Bethlehem and make a diligent search, and then let me know where this newborn king is. He intended to kill him. But the whole point is, Bethlehem being a small village, it wouldn't be that difficult to find a home where there was a couple with a toddler age firstborn son. And so they would have found this child. But seeing the star reappear as they were on their way from Jerusalem to Bethlehem would have confirmed for them they were on the right track. It would have emboldened them to continue their mission and find this king of the Jews and pay appropriate homage to him. So in that sense, the star did not, quote, guide the way or point out the exact address of the house. They wouldn't need that. Being such a small village, you could easily find that without the star guiding them. But the star did confirm that indeed they were on the right mission and on the right track to find this newborn child. And again, what impresses me about the wise men is the faith they had to carry out their mission to display the appropriate humility and worship of the newborn king, the king of us all.
Thank you for your comments, Hugh. We hope you have found this helpful. We want to recommend a few resources if you want to delve further into the topic. Hugh, you have written a couple of articles on the Christmas star that people can find on our website. We've also, Jeff Zwerink has written an article, Today's New Reasons to Believe article. Also, you have recorded an audio podcast as part of the I Didn't Know That. People can find that on our website. And what else have we written on that topic?
Well, that's a whole package. There's a place on our website where all of those resources are right available, but they can also see them in other places.
You type in Christmas Star, it appears on our website, reasons.org. Thanks for watching.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink. Welcome back to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific and intellectual ideas and how they relate to the truth of Christianity. And today I'm excited because we get to talk about Christmas, which is one of the important times of the year for Christians. And I'm joined by my colleague and friend, Ken Samples, and we're going to reflect on what Christmas is about. Ken, it's good to have you here today.
Hi, Jeff.
So Christmas, hands down, is one of the most popular celebrations, clearly in the West, maybe not, if not around the world. Secular, theistic, religious, get into that. I just want to kind of spend a little bit of time getting at the heart of why Christmas is so important to Christians. What is it that we are really doing at Christmas time?
Yeah, I think if you go back in church history, the liturgical, the traditional churches, Catholic, Orthodox, Anglican, Lutheran, Reformed, they have a church calendar, and they note very significant events in the life of Christ. Just as Christians see great significance in Easter as the resurrection, mm-hmm. so Christmas is to the incarnation. And, you know, Scripture says, Paul says, that our lives are now hidden in Christ. And so the church developed a calendar that we would live our lives according to these great events in the life of Jesus. And so Christmas is a particular day, but it is part of the season we call Advent, the coming of the Lord. And so December 25th was a significant, we might say, pagan festival. Mm-hmm. But I think the goal there was to say, rather than changing people's devotion, rather than changing the day, they changed the focus. Was Jesus born on December 25th? Probably not. But that was a day attributed to his birth.
So the big important part of Christmas is celebrating the birth of Jesus then, correct? The, you know, his advent, his incarnation in there.
Yes.
And, you know, in your writings, I know that you have connected the incarnation back to creation. What's the connection there?
Yeah, I think it's marvelous. Obviously, we're made in the image of God. I mean, that is a central biblical teaching. But I would say that we're made in the image of God because all along God planned to become one of us. Hmm. So making us in the image of God, Adam and Eve, made in the image of God, male and female, when Christ becomes man, he is taking a nature that is likened unto himself. And so the incarnation plays a unique role. The Imago Dei plays a unique role for the incarnation. And so creation anticipates redemption.
Well, it's just kind of an interesting thought, because a lot of times people will talk, even in the church and maybe even outside, it's like, well, God created things, man kind of messed it up, and then God's kind of fixing it, if you will, with the incarnation. Yeah. If I get what you're saying, that from the moment of creation, God has this plan built into place.
Absolutely. And I think we go back to the book of Genesis, chapter 3. There is the fall. Adam and Eve rebelled against God. But Genesis 3:15, there is a reference that Christ will come. Mm. And so I think we see it right when things break down, right from the moment of the fall, there is then the pointing to the gospel.
So, you know, what you said earlier, okay, the idea of Jesus being born on December 25th probably has a 1 in about 365 chance, if you will.
Sounds so good.
So there's nothing particularly significant about the day, but the celebration is important.
Yeah.
But you talk about Christmas now, and you got Christmas trees and lights and gifts, and what do we do with all that? Because that seems kind of pagan. Are we not just adopting pagan practices?
Well, let's take the day. December 25th did have a Western, solstice element to it, and so that would go back to non-Christian pagan roots. But notice what the church did. It changed the focus. It's no longer on pagan ideas. Now it's on Christ has come into the world. The giving of gifts, by the way, is fairly late in church history. I mean, if you went back a few hundred years ago, you wouldn't necessarily see that. That may relate to some of our commercialization, mm-hmm. et cetera. But I think the idea, Martin Luther brought a Christmas tree into the church. These are ideas that developed over centuries. And I think by and large, it's a time of celebration. It's a time to have a good meal together, to go to church together. And I love looking at the Christmas decorations. It reminds me in one more way that Christ came into the world.
So is there something that you would recommend that we do so that we don't get caught up in the secular way of looking at this? You know, like how big a gift we can give, kind of the commercialization, or what's the biggest tree, or maybe even the worship of the trees, if you will. What can we do to keep our focus off of that onto what's truly important?
Well, I think that many churches celebrate Advent, and so that would be the December months, the first few weeks in anticipation. A lot of times families will light a candle together to celebrate. There'll be messages at the church that are preached about the coming of Christ. I mean, all you have to do is look to the Gospels. Matthew, mm-hmm. Mark, and Luke talk about the birth of Jesus. So I think if you put the focus less on how expensive a gift you want to buy or receive, maybe focusing on the idea. I mean, I like to say that the Earth is the visited planet. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that the Apollo astronauts walked on the moon. It's a greater thing for God to walk on the Earth. That's a pretty special time.
That is really pretty remarkable and special. And you know, the discussion you had about how we're created in God's image and Christ comes kind of in that creation anticipating where we are. What are, you know, obviously beyond the importance of the incarnation there, what are things that are good to celebrate and to be focused on in this Christmas season?
Well, you know, Jesus is not just God. He is the second person of the Trinity. So he's fully God. He shares that divine essence with the Father and the Spirit, but he's also fully man. He is a real human being. He shared our humanity. Now, Jesus wasn't fallen as we are fallen, mm-hmm. but because he represents both God and man, he can reconcile God and man. So now we move from the Imago Dei, the image of God, to Advent and Christmas, and then we focus on the cross, because he can reconcile God and man. So I think the doctrine of the incarnation and the celebration of Christmas is right at the heart of historic Christianity.
Well, thanks, Ken. I really appreciate your comments. You know, when we enter Christmas, it is very easy to get distracted into the commercial celebrations or the decorations. And I think they're important because they encourage us to remember and focus on what's truly important. And what's truly important is that God, the creator of the universe, sent his son to come and take on human flesh to show who we are, that we are his image bearers. Not only do we remember that we are his image bearers, but that he, by coming and living among us, actually gives us a hope to live with God forever in eternity that is just impossible otherwise. You know, I'd encourage you to go to reasons.org. Check out Ken's blog on this. It's called Reflections on Christmas by Ken Samples. Gives you some great ideas about how to think about Christmas, what to focus on, and how to share the hope that God provides through this Advent season to all the people he brings across your path.
That does it for us this week on 2819 and wraps up the year for us and
I
the Christmas
know.
Season, right?
2022, here we come.
Hopefully it's a good one.
I know. Let's hope. But, you know, we hope also that you have been encouraged throughout the year to go out and to share your faith. And, you know, hopefully you're cozied around with some loved ones and you're going to just celebrate the conclusion of this year and look forward to seeing us again in 2022.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about social media.
Yes. We would love to hear from you. Let us know your holiday plans, maybe your New Year's resolutions. So you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at 2819 Show. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
I would actually love to see some pictures of how people dress up their animals for Christmas.
Oh,
especially
I
their
know.
Cats.
I mean, I know someone who crochets scarves for their dogs, points to self. For our podcast listeners. So, you know, it's kind of fun to have our furry friends get festive too.
Yeah, so send us pictures on Facebook and Twitter. Sandra
and
will
Instagram.
Probably post one of hers, right?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, if you'd like the podcast version of our show, we're on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next year.
Merry Christmas.